going to museum, even going to galleries, the whole infrastructure is Western.
I didn't know what architect was, but I was like, oh, this is how you build things. I mean, architecture is the business of branding, right? It's a business of image making, of identity. I mean, the sands, the stone, the cement are so different.
Completely
so
different.
It's a culture. It's like cooking, right? You can try to cook the same dish, like fried rice.
Yeah.
But
with a different ingredient.
It's so different.
So with that, you are capturing it and growing that that younger audience.
But what is about you? Like, it's unique because of who you are. Wow, that's a tough question.
Yeah. Name me three. Name me three. Hello, this is Pearl Lamb Podcast. I'm sitting here in LA with the famous Kudapat, who has been doing architecture, design, and all around the world. So Kudapat, can you just give a very brief about yourself to the audience who may not be in the area of architecture and design?
Thank you, Pearl. So I was born in Thailand. And then spent 15 years in Japan. I studied there master's and PhD, and then worked closely with my mentor, Tada Wando, in Osaka for 8 years, which I worked with him on so many projects around the world before I decided that I need to start my own. So I moved to the US 2004. And set up my studios in Los Angeles first, and then New York. So this year is actually our 20th anniversary of our studio called Y. And fortunately, we're based in these two cities, but we work mostly globally. And now, majority of our work is actually in Asia, in Europe, and in the Middle East. And we are, you know, trying to ramp up our work in America as well. But for some reasons, the work in the culture art section is happening so much outside as well. So thank you and happy to be here.
Kudapat, since when do you know that you wanted to study architecture?
Around 6 years old.
6 years old?
Why you look at me like you're looking angry? I did not know, but I knew that was kind of because, you know, I was taken to Paris when I was six. But then, so that's the first part of it. The second part, when I was 7 years old, we didn't go anywhere because we normally go someplace. And we stay home because our house has a renovation, right? And I was there in my room, like the size of this room, a little bit bigger. And I was told by my parents that, oh, we're going to do renovation. I was like, I know. So in my room, in my bed, and all of a sudden that wall, because I was like sleeping late, I didn't want to, and they always start working, I just ignore them. All of a sudden the whole wall was removed. And so I was like, what is that? And then all of a sudden you see the mango trees on the other side. And I was like, what? Like when you're a child, you just kind of adapt to the space you're given to, right?
Yeah.
I was lucky to have my own bedroom, but I was like, what?
That wall
was just removed. And I was like, whoa, what is that? And then my father, who was an engineer, who's retired, was like, oh, since you're here not having anything to do, why don't you just follow the workers and pick up the nails? And at the end of the day, you can collect them and sell it back to me. So because I didn't have anything to do, I was such a bother at home, I guess. So I was just following them and collecting these nails and things, and sometimes help them clean up and think of Chinese style, right?
Yeah.
And then I do that and I collect that and start hanging out with them. And there's like, oh, give me a hammer. So like, oh, give me a hammer of that, right? And just like, and sometimes they just like, oh, give me nail to sell it to my father. And so I was kind of like maybe for 2 months, I was like hanging out with the crew. And so I liked the idea like, oh, at least I kind of know, I didn't know what architect was, but I was like, oh, this is how you build things, right? Including my own bedroom too. So I felt like, oh, I get it. And so it gave me a little bit of a sense of power that you can actually make your own environment, right? I mean, when you're a child, we forgot how we felt so helpless as a child, because you're so depending on your parents, you're so dependent on where you go, what to eat, or whatever, right? But when building things, that's why I think kids like toolbox.
Yeah, toolbox.
Right? Because they can kind of put this thing up because they feel like they're in power of something. And in that note, based on that renovation, it gave me the sense like, oh, I can do this. I can kind of be part of this.
So from 7 years old, you wanted to build buildings.
I thought, I mean, that was deep into my DNA, but I was such a good student. And so my mother and her clan was like, doctor. So I was about to become a doctor until I got into college, about to. And the night before I have to put in the exam, late at night, I knock on my parents' door and say, I don't want to be a doctor. I'm almost crying. It's like, I don't want to be a doctor. I want to become an architect. But I was such a good student. So everyone said, oh, we need a doctor in the family.
Typical Chinese family. We need a doctor. We need an accountant. You have to study that. Yeah.
And because I was able to, right? Because I was such a good student. So I always loved to study. And then they let me become an architect. So between 7 and, let's say, 17, I didn't even think about architecture at all. I was grooming myself to please my mother's expectation to become a doctor. So then at that point, it was a turning point because I felt like I cannot do this. I need to do something else. And I saw them 2 weeks ago. They were just kind of laughing at me.
They must be so proud of you now.
They were not sure because I play along with them, right? I play along, I study.
Like all Chinese children, they just play along long until the very end.
Yeah. And I think it's funny because when I said that to them, my father said one thing which is interesting. He said, he said to my mother, like, well, we have enough money, not a lot, but even if he messed up at what he wanted to do, he's a little good life, so let him do what he wanted.
And then, wow, so understanding.
Yeah, it was. At the time, I was like, what are you talking about? And then he turned around to me and said, well, you know, one thing is that you'll never be rich because as an architect, you're selling service.
Oh, right. No, Norman Foster is very rich.
That's true. And there are a lot of them. There are ways to do it in general. But there's one out of a million, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, I think, you know, going back to what we said before about challenge, right? Perhaps we would not be able to do what we do today if we were not challenged by our parents or the previous generation. And again, you know, it's different because in Asia, we were not trained to, like in the West, that you have to kill your father to be yourself,
yeah,
right? Which is such a Western way of thinking. In Asia, we just move the needle a little bit. We just evolve.
But I always say to some of my friends who are parents now, I said the biggest problem I feel in the West and the East culture, the same thing. We never teach children to be themselves and to love themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Because we always, you know, in the West, they always have a hero worship. Oh, you have to be like this, you have to be like... I mean, none of the children, none of all my contemporaries, all my friends' children, even of this age, would say to the little girls or little boys, say, you know, it's really important to know who you are. And until you know who you are, you don't have the strength. And then you have to love who you are. Then you become someone.
Mm-hmm.
We never thought about that.
I think you touch on such an important point. You know, loneliness is the biggest disease now among young people, right? Because it feels like with social network and other things are supposed to connect people. Ooh. Not really. People feel alone and feel so.
But you see, if you start loving yourself, you love to spend time with yourself. And therefore, you will never have such problems.
I agree. I think we pitch people against each other.
Yeah.
Look at him. He does so much better.
Yes, exactly.
Why don't you be like him or this and that, right?
I always wanted to ask you, okay, you are Thai, you study architecture in Thailand. Why choose Japan?
Mm.
Why Japan? Because Thai architecture and Japanese architecture is You know, Japanese is always very quiet, very meditative. Thai is very ornamental. So how did you, from Thai going to Japan?
Thank you. When I was in Japan, you know, I was really wondering and almost obsessing about what should be contemporary Thai architecture, right? We see something that look like a copy from the past.
Absolutely.
Or we have a copy from the West, right? So we don't have that DNA to evolve, right? And so, and then I realized that we can't really learn from the West because the West have different problems, right? The West create amazing modern culture, modern architecture, like Le Corbusier that you mentioned. But they have different problems.
Completely.
The problems that we have is how we really endure and sustain and thrive with our tradition, but integrated with the modern culture, modern life. And so I was like, oh, I cannot really learn from Europe or America. I have to learn from people in our same situation. So I start looking at Japan. I start looking at Mexico. I start looking at Brazil.
Mm.
Because these places have, you know, Barragan, Oscar Niemeyer, Tange, Ando, Ito, right? And so then I was like, yeah, I need to look at these places. And even though, as you say, Japan is so minimal and Thailand is so maximal, right? So, but there's a sense of Asian culture, Buddhism. We eat rice. So the whole sense about it.
And proportion.
Yeah. And so I was fascinated by that. So, okay, I'm going to go to Japan. So that was my destiny.
And to work in Endo, Tando Endo, I was always told that Tando Endo is very, one of the, I met one of the architects who used to work for him. He said he would use the fingers, a pencil to beat the head. He's very tough, I was told.
Is he very tough? He's very physical. I worked very closely with him for 8 years, right? And it's my first and only job. I never worked for anyone else, so I don't have anything to compare. But I think he's very focused and very determined for his path. So that passion and that dedication is definitely admirable, right? So that's one. He's also very physical because he used to be a boxer.
Oh, really?
Yes, he used to be a boxer. So I think that might be some of that. I mean, I joined him 1996, 2003, and maybe less than what he known to do that. But he's still very intense. He's a very intense person. And that's why the work talked about this intensity. The work talked about this spirituality that is involved. But one thing I can tell you, that he really walked the talk. You know, he talked about spirits. He talked about, you know, the light and the philosophy and his work, when you see it, it speaks of those concepts
because,
as well.
Yeah, because I was in Osaka, I took a guide to go and look at all the Endo's building. And there was one building I still remember, it was a Buddhist temple and underneath a lotus pond. And it's fascinating.
That's one of my favorite work also.
I mean, fascinating, really fascinating. It's not big,
but
it's small, but that intensity
just makes
me scream.
You're absolutely right. And in this case, it's quite fascinating because as an experience, it's so beautiful and inspiring. But in this very minimal gesture, it's half the context of Buddhism, right, which is about lotus, and about going down in yourself like a lotus from the mud and slowly rise up to the sky and bloom. So I think within that minimalist gesture, it has both the experience, which is quite meaningful, but also the philosophical context, yeah.
Because when I see Endo's building, it is the volume, and that's why it's fantastic when he builds museum. So I can see how, you know, all the galleries and all the museum once could have packed you to design, because to understand volume is not many architects who, you know, the simplicity of this volume to put the artwork is special.
Thank you. I love that. But, you know, but to be honest, the reason why I also left Japan is because I felt, you know, after 15 years in Japan, that it is so beautiful and unique, but it's like its own isolated world. Yeah, it's so isolated, right? And I felt like, you know, my Thai roots were showing. I started to kind of want diversity, richness, smell, and you know, all the senses. But I felt that in Japan, there's less so. I continue to really be in love with it, but still,
yeah. It's really homogeneous.
Very much so, you're absolutely right. And I felt that, you know, in a weird way, it seems like there's only one game in town. Right, but they're doing that game so well. But for someone who's not from there, I feel like I learned a lot from that. But I want to really connect this to the world as well. It's like that kind of sense of, because I'm also, you know, from the south, right?
Yeah.
Thailand. I also relate to people from hot countries like Brazil, like Mexico. I love that human aspect of it, which I maybe find less in Japan. And so I felt like America is a kind of a fertile ground for all of these to go together.
But why not Europe? Why America?
I thought about that because
Europe have all the traditions. So it's great that when you look at Europe and see how it evolved philosophically to become a contemporary architecture.
You're absolutely right on that. You know, and before I left to start my own firm, I was working a lot in Europe, you know, in Paris mostly. So that was definitely my obvious options as well. But I felt, for some reason, I felt maybe at the time, Europe didn't have a lot of opportunities for someone like me who was an immigrant, right? I felt America was more open, and I felt that it's more forgiving. I particularly love L.A. because I felt, at the time I was 35, and I was like, oh, I'm too old for New York. Right, I don't want to go and work as a slave for the city. I want to just start something, and when it comes to LA, it seems so forgiving. Like it's open. It feels like you can make mistakes. You can do all these things, and to be honest, you know, Frank Gehry was someone that really gave me a lot of inspiration, because look at him. You know, he's from Canada, right? And then come back here, and make architecture out of chain links, out of you know, cardboard and things like that. And I feel like, well, this is where the new vocabulary, the new language can start, because no one owned it. It's not like we have a European tradition that you have to kind of go against or go with, right? It's something that's kind of open. And the artist, you know, as you know so well, because you're so, you know, connected to everyone in the light and space, just give
the
it
light and space
such
is amazing.
A, you know, such an inspiration aspect. And maybe because it's sort of linked me back to Japan, the sense of the essence, the sense of the emptiness and the space, yeah.
So is this why, you know, your first office you set in L.A. or New York here?
In L.A. first, yes.
Was it difficult, you know, as a new, young architect, an Asian as well? How do you get your first project?
I guess I was lucky. First, you know, I was working on a house project at the Ando office, right? Happened to be in Malibu, which got sold to a very high price, right? So I was working on it in Osaka as Ando's, you know, project architect. And the same project, when I moved here, I got to know the client quite well. So the client's like, oh, you have to continue to work on this. So I continued to work on it. In the beginning, I didn't want to work on it because I felt like I don't want to be attached to Ando all the time. But this is a project that means so close to my heart because I know the client very well. I work on it from the beginning. And I felt like, oh, this is a good way of training my own staff too. Like, because when you work on something at a very highest level in terms of construction, in terms of the expectation, it could be a beautiful thing. So we have that. But very quickly, we got our first museum, which is the Grand Rapids Art Museum, which we opened.
You were the new architect, even though with Tato Endo's experience connection, to get a museum is incredible.
I think, you know, luck is a definitely big part in my life and everyone's life, but I don't think it's just drop on you. I think, as you said, you prepare yourself to receive, you know, the opportunities. And when it come, you can hit it. You can write. You go into it. So I felt like it's that way, right? Because everyone, you know, it's independent on what you bring to the table and what will drop on the table. I think in that case, it was fortunate because someone that I know before know that I just opened an office in Los Angeles and come knock on the door and say, we had a problem. Can you come fix it for us? And I said, oh, well, should I start my career with a problem? And then I feel like maybe not. Maybe we should do something else, like from the beginning, rather than go and fix a problem. But when I went to see them, which I was not planning to take the job, I felt, oh, they need me. I can help this situation. I know how to help this situation. And so I stay on. But anyway, long story short, I was able to really make it our project and built it. In this case, it was the first LEED Gold museum in America, which is also in the world. It's the first art museum that really talked about sustainability and how you use materials, how you use energy, right? At that time, this is 2004, it opened
That's 2007. That's very early to talk about sustainability. Yeah.
And everyone was kind of afraid, like, oh, it's going to cost more money, it's going to make it difficult to maintain. Not really. There's a lot of myth around that. And so we proved that to be the case. But for that reason, I decided to use concrete, which I didn't want to because it's too endo. Yeah, but let me tell you a quick story about Elsworth Kelly.
Yeah,
who is a very dear friend, who you know, I knew from my time at Andos, right? So we commissioned Elsworth to do a big piece of his sculpture in the lobby of the museum, and we went to have dinner together after. He was so shocked how big the museum is because he only saw the little tiny model that he built. It's like, oh my God. I mean, and Elsworth, here's someone that's been so kind to me because when they moved here, and he said, where are you going for Thanksgiving? And have no idea how Thanksgiving is like a sad time for immigrants because they all go back to their family. And so it's like, why Thanksgiving? He's like, oh, you can come Thanksgiving with us. So I've been going to Thanksgiving with him and Jack for many years, not knowing.
Oh, so every year after that,
yeah,
until you pass away.
No, not knowing that that was like his somewhat cherry towards me, like, oh, he's going to be alone by himself, no family here, right? But, you know, so he took me in. And so, so we had that kind of interesting relationship. And so after his installation of his work, we went to have dinner nearby, and we all drank wine and have a great time, and asked Elsworth, like, well, Elsworth, I really didn't want to use concrete for this project, but I know how to do it inexpensively, and I know how to do it sustainably. But do you think that people would think of this as an Andor building? And he said, no. And I said, why? He said, well, you know, Andor is Japanese. He's all about control. It's about moving, going this way, look right. There's a window, you look out, you see a tree. Everything is about control, the choreography of space.
Yeah.
That's why it's so strong, it's so beautiful. And he said, you're Thai, you're very open and you're generous. You want people to look left and look right and look up and look down, options and all of that. He said, even though it's the same material, it's completely different spaces. And when he said that,
is this true?
I was like, it gave me like the liberations, like, oh.
But he is really, I mean, he can see things very, he has this clarity,
yeah,
which is amazing.
I was shocked about that because, of course, I only know him through his work. And when we meet, we always talk about his work, right? We never talk about my work. And so when I ask him about my work, how articulate it is and how insightful that was, it was almost like a blessing for me.
Yeah.
Like, yes, you can use concrete because concrete exists, you know, with Le Corbusier, with the Roman, with so many people in history of architecture. So therefore, you can use this material and do whatever with it. And if you have the DNA to do it, it will be yours.
Kutubat, I know that you designed for the LA Freeze, the pavilion, right? Right, how do you come up? Because there's so many architects. Why would they choose a Thai architect living in LA for this pavilion?
Well, we work with Freeze LA since the beginning, right? It was at the Paramount studio, and then we moved to Beverly Hills and now in Santa Monica for the second year. I don't know, but I think I'm part of the art community here.
Yeah, I know.
And I think they like the idea that perhaps I designed some galleries. I did one for David Kadansky here, both in the LA and some others as well. But, you know, many architects design galleries too. But I think they like the idea that I'm also kind of inclusive, that I also like to create place. You know, for me, like, it gives me so much joy when I see people gather in my space and they're happy, they converse. So I hope that maybe that's a reason why they do that. And this year, again, this is the second year at the Santa Monica Airport. So the tent is much larger than last year. We won space. Last year was split into two. And so we also really deployed the indoor-outdoor. So there's all the whole gardens and sculpture installation outside. We have the different pavilions for food, for nonprofits and things. A lot more places for people to hang out and chill. Because, yes, it is an art fair, but at the end of the day, it's more than that, right? We all know that.
We're
all here for that, right? The whole city for the whole week.
The socializing is really important as well. You create that space so that people can connect with each other.
Absolutely, because I think art fair is it's kind of the kitchen, right, or the place, but people stay. So if you design to the place that people want to look at the art and they stay, you know, gallery has a chance to meet with the collectors. Collectors can meet with the curators. Artists can hang out too. One thing that I'm very proud about Freeze LA is I go to a lot of art fairs, almost every art fair all over the world. I would say that Freeze Art Fair is the one I see the most artists. They come to see their work. They bring their friends, right?
That's
so it's
wonderful.
A feel like a lot of times artists
because
are very...
Because there's so many artists living in L.A.
That's true.
Hot.
But even New York, artists are allergic to art fairs. They don't want to come to the art fair because they don't want to be seen in this kind of somewhat of a commercial context, right? But it's very healthy. You know, it depends on how you look at it because a gallery is a commerce, right? So I think sometimes people have this weird thinking about that, but culture and commerce are always together. Always.
Of course.
Right. So I think that's important to talk about how one support each other. One cannot survive without the other. So I feel that with Freeze Art Fair, we definitely try to bring it in. And I'm proud to live here because the community is so close. The artists always show up to things, and the artists are so friendly. They want people to come to see the studio. They want to share their stories. And when an artist has an opening, all their friends are coming. It's very...
Very supportive.
It's a very supportive, exactly, yeah.
Also, I think just now I miss asking you, is your bridge project in 2010, can you elaborate and talk about this to the audience?
Well, thank you. So this Art Bridge project was the one that we started working with Judy Barker, who's an amazing street artist who's been celebrated so many aspects, including LACMA last year and many others. And so Judy and her team at Spark had painted this wall on the LA River, right, for the last 40 years. Is a history of LA from immigration, from water, from politics, from minorities, right? It's on the channel of the river. And in 2004, she asked me to collaborate with her to create this bridge to cross the river, but also function as a platform from which you can see the walls and the river. And so I went there, this is 2004, I was like excited. It's one of my first projects too. It was a pro bono project. And it's like, oh my God, this is exciting. But when I went there, the river was full of trash, like shopping carts, debris, I mean, you name it.
Don't tell me it's like your Thai river.
Very, very.
Really?
It very much so, but I was coming from Japan, right? I'm like excited about. So I was kind of shocked and angry. Like, what? How can people do this to a river, right? Which is like, you know, in Thailand we have that too. But I was expecting something out of, I was just moved to America a few months ago. So I was like, okay, I'm going to give you back your what to give to the river. So you give trash to the river, I'm going to use the trash to build a bridge that you have to see every day. So you need to know that trash is you too. Right, so I then started to think about how to build this bridge out of trash. I started to, you know, it started from an angry, but also kind of like, okay, let's give them what they want.
Give them what they want.
And so, which is like weirdly American, which is our consumerism and waste and stuff, right? And so I started looking, I was like, okay, well, how do I bridge? So I started to think about, okay, well, it's a bridge, it needs a long span, so long story short, we find a way to make the railing out of shopping carts, right? So we cut the shopping carts and make railing. The floor of the bridge is made from recycled tiles. We pick all of the small trash you put into the mix of the concrete. So you can see like old cell phones, you can see plastic, whatever it is that we embed into in the concrete wall. So it's ongoing. We finally building it after because it was a pro bono project and then we start getting some fees to do it. And then we had to get all the donation to build the building and stuff. So it takes some time, but now finally under construction.
Wow, that's fantastic.
I'm so pleased about it because it also give us, you know, the chance to work with the community to salvage the trash and clean the river and things like that.
No, I have one big question for you. Is in Japan, when they use concrete, the polished concrete, the quality of it is beautiful. It's just perfect.
Mm-hmm.
I can't see how LA or any other countries can produce that sort of quality. So how have you been dealing with this problem?
Well, you know, to be honest, you know, when I was working with Tadawando, all of the projects I work on are all overseas.
Mm.
So, and I was the only foreigner working in that office at that time.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I was a person who fly over from one project to the other, like working with the Italians, working with the French, working with the British, working with the Chinese, working with Americans, to do the best concrete. But what we were doing was not to try to import or export Japanese concrete. We tried to go to each place and try to cook the best out of that ingredients. So when you go to Italy, right? I mean, the sands, the stone, the cement are so different.
Completely different.
It's a culture. It's like cooking, right? You can try to cook the same dish, like fried rice.
Yeah.
But
with a different ingredient.
It's so different. The rice is different. The oil is different. So therefore, it's really quite fun. And so you have to go in a place of respect. You have to first know what they do, right? And then it's like, oh, well, let's elevate the quality. Let's make it consistent. Let's make the color clear. Let's make the detail.
Oh, I never knew that because this is my biggest question, right? Mm-hmm. I always have this question. So you go to Naoshima, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Every single of these buildings, you touch the concrete, it's smooth.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's beautiful. And the floor never have a crack. And it's beautiful. So I go back to Hong Kong, I go to New York. Concrete is really different. But if you are using concrete as a material to build your building, that's what I always wanted to ask. How do you control it? But with your explanation, it's great.
Concrete is so human.
It's great.
Right? Because the ingredient is so simple. And it really, the labor. What I liked about concrete is that it doesn't bullshit. Like, it is what it is. If you didn't do a good job with the form, if you didn't do a good job with the mix, it shows. There's
yeah,
no
absolutely.
Decoration.
Absolutely.
There's no hiding. There's no molding, right? So it's really come down to the carpentry of the workshop, the mix, and the choreography of the pour. So I think that, you know, and if I go around the world, I know exactly where, like, Italy concrete, like, if you see from the work that I do with François Pinault, at the Dogana, the Punta della Dogana, that's a beautiful, excellent concrete, right? If you go to the house in Malibu that we did, that's another very different concrete, but so excellent as well.
So every time when you do a project, let's say that you do a project here, so all the concrete you use is from one manufacturer that you use and then...
Not at all. Every time it's different. If you would do a work even in Malibu or, let's say, in Palm Springs, right? It depends on who are the closest supplier of cement, of sands, of aggregates. You cook it together, almost like you talk to the general contractor, how you do that, you create mock-up. And the most important thing about concrete is consistency.
Yeah.
Because you want it to be, let's say if you have a wall which is 100 feet long, 200 feet long, you want it to feel one piece.
Yes.
You don't want to see it as checker blocks or something, a problem, right? So no matter what color it is, it's about the intention and the quality control that go into it. So we focus on that. And I think that it's a lot of training, but it has to start with a place of respect, that we have to start respecting the workers. But then it's like being a coach. You respect your players, but you elevate the players to where they were normally to a better place.
So, okay, your clients, when you first arrived there, I don't think that many of your clients will understand concrete structure or concrete building, because you arrived like 2004, 2005. Mm-hmm. Five now is very common, right? Before, when you first came here, when you start designing projects, does people say to you, hey, we don't want this. We want a little bit more glamorous. We're Hollywood.
Well, interesting. Yeah, you're right. But I think, people, the best clients are the curious clients.
Yeah.
Right? If they know what they want, they can go out and build it. And yes. Some people might think so. But once we develop a sense of trust, once we go to see things together, and I'm also very, because I also love art, so I talk a lot about art, yeah. I talk a lot about things, and when we start to know each other, go through the places, and of course, clients always compare themselves to their friends and other collectors and other people, right? So they want a unique moment. And so you can also kind of like, yes, but what is about you? Like, it's unique because of who you are. It's not unique because it doesn't look like someone else. And so with that trust, we started to build this understanding of the sense of who they are. I mean, architecture is the business of branding, right? It's a business of image making, mm-hmm. of identity, the good ones. Right, and that's why architecture always used for politics, for brand, for anything, right? So within that kind of possibility, you have the chance of really working with your client to build something which is extremely unique.
You always build the best building if you have a very demanding, demanding developer.
That's true. I think it's like a collaboration.
Yeah, right? It's a collaboration.
I think both should challenge each other, right? I think like Frank Israel, an architect who passed, always talked about himself as he's the shadow of the client, or the project is a shadow of the client. Like there's some cases where architecture exists with our clients, right? That you just create this thing and it just happened. And it's beautiful, and it might be timeless. There's a lot of cases where you, like, for example, like the Middleton Collection, in Houston, which is considered one of the best museums in America. Renzo Piano is quite young, right? In the beginning, the Minil was planning to work with Luc Kahn, but he passed away, right? And so Renzo was the person. And with Renzo, together with Mrs. de Minil, that was the
they created the team, a monument.
And
I think that's
still not 100%, but that's one main way of creating good masterpieces, is that trust, but also challenge.
You have to challenge.
Exactly.
Because if you challenge, you will push the boundaries.
Otherwise, everyone get into too much of a comfortable position.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So among all the buildings that you've built, which is your best project, you consider as your best project?
Wow, that's a tough question.
Yeah. Name me three. Name me three.
Well, I think it's always, of course, the first project, which is the Grand Rapids Art Museum, right? It's something that, of course, is the first baby.
Yeah.
Right? And we went through so much within 3 years that I told my staffs, like, if we survive all this together, you guys are going to learn so much out of this. It's like that. So that's always the case. And my own house, which is a tiny little house, but...
Can you invite me there, please?
Of course. And it's weird because I'm like the last architect who wanted to design my own house. I'm the last photographer.
Why? Wanted,
because I felt that I should be doing this for other people.
No, you have to do this for
maybe
yourself.
Because I was concerned. It's like photographer taking their own self-portrait, right? Like, why are you doing that, right? There are artists who like to do their own self-portrait, and there are artists who never do that. Right, they always do portrait of other people. So I'm like the second type. And so when the time comes, when I feel like I need a place, I keep looking and looking and looking, and it's like, oh God, I cannot afford this. This is not good enough, blah, blah, blah. So in the end, it's like, okay, I have to do my own. And so that process of building my own house really allowed me to understand even more. I put myself in the shoes of the client.
Yes.
I understand how to think about the anxiety of building something, not just only finance, but who are you, right? Yeah. You know, many things. So that definitely is a meaningful thing, for sure. Well, you give me a last one. Even though I'm an architect, I'm such a sucker for gardens and trees. I think for me, it is the ultimate art form.
Don't you like those Kyoto sand garden? I just love those sand gardens.
Oh, and how they teach us so much about, you know, how to live on Earth.
Yeah. Right?
Your nature, you're part of nature, but you're not. You also have your own consciousness and being, right? So within that, we designed a garden / pavilion in Scotland for the Ross Pavilion, which is right in the middle of Edinburgh, right under the castle. So that, I was so pleased with it because it really integrated landscape and architecture into one. You don't really know where architecture ends and where gardens start. It become one thing. And when I look back at it, I mean, we won the competition 7 years ago. When I look back at it, there's nothing I want to change about it. You know, it doesn't mean it's fixed.
Wow, that's great.
But it also give a lot of, like, the overall concept is easy, right? Not easy, but it's kind of defined. And within that, the botanist can do something they want. It's not going to change anything. So it welcome, it's kind of defined, but also open-ended that other people can do work on it too. So I kind of like that notion, yeah.
Oh, okay, so next thing is, you've been here for now 20 years. I mean, so you start with LA, you move to, when did you open your...
And New York is around 14 years ago. So LA is 20, New York is 14. New York is now a bigger office. You know, we're doing a wing at the Met. Called the Rockefeller Wing, which we won the selection around 6 years ago. It's actually open next spring, 2025.
Wow, that's fantastic.
Yeah, and it's something that I'm so excited about, not because yet it's another museum, but I felt that in this time, museums, what I call, are sites of empathy, right? Like it's when I designed the Rockefeller Wing, which is collection of Africa's, Oceania's, and art from the Americas.
The ancient Americas. Know which yes. I know,
so
the Oceanic.
Yeah, so I'm not just dealing with New Yorkers, right? I remember myself as a Thai boy, you know, went to see the Louvre for the first time and see Egyptian art, right, or African art, right? So these places are not just for local people, right? Like I can imagine a Chinese a boy going to the Met for the first time and see African art.
Wow.
So it's my job to make sure that they like each other, the sense of, you know, understanding. And I think in a world now that we are so full of conflicts and hate and misunderstanding of each other,
yeah.
Right? I think it's sadly come down to food and art.
Yeah, I think so. This is culture, right?
Yes.
This is what we call about culture, and culture is really important.
Yeah. And it's invisible, but it's needed. It's that glue that allowed, like, for example, I mean, weirdly, like, my father's Chinese, my mother's Thai. My mother did not like anything at all Chinese, except Chinese food. Right, and she doesn't like Chinese rituals. She doesn't like Chinese decorations or anything like that at all. But when it comes to Chinese food, her passion.
Wow!
Right? So I think that food and art has this like really undeniable power to bring people together. Like we try to kind of slap each other with our doctrines and our, you know, you need to understand me. I'm here first and whatever, right? But I think if you can solve the soft things with like food and art, which you do so well
this
with your
soft culture,
with your
right?
Soft exactly,
soft power, and this is things that you can bring people together, which I think is you're absolutely right. It's really important, especially food. I mean, it's so easy. You can just invite people, they sit together, they eat, and then they start talking with each other.
Yeah.
In Asians, and I don't know about Thai, but the Chinese is if you're a collector, you don't hang your paintings everywhere. There is a little treasure room, usually your studies. So invite all your friends, going there, drinking tea or drinking wine, and then because it's scroll, you open it. And you share it. All the carving of these jade, and so you speak, you enjoy yourself. It's not like the West. But now, our whole lifestyle has changed. We don't have this Asian lifestyle. We go in the house, everybody is hanging. So we lost that sort of lifestyle. So as an architect, when you design things, how are you, you know, you're not promoting a different lifestyle. You're doing this, and how do you merge?
Well, how I are think you museum, going to introduce? You know, there's a lot of talk about what is the role of a museum in 21st century, right? Again, it started before, but museum become what it is with the 19th century concept of colonization, right? People show, I mean, when you look at all the big, the great museums in the world, they're all
materials. Of course, look at British Museum.
Or the Louvre, the they're all Guimet. From the colony. It's about showing what we have from our colonies.
Yeah. Right. By invading
but
and conquering.
But that's okay. Right. But then we need to think about, okay, how do we take the museum away from their sense of possession, sense of conquering, to talk about creativity, talk about, again, empathy of culture,
and also melting of using these objects to understand the culture, the philosophy.
Yeah, so you don't have to throw the baby with the water, like meaning the treasure's still there.
Yeah.
We just have to reposition to look at them not as a product of colonization.
Not as a conquest.
But as objects or as a point of departure to tell stories.
Yeah.
Rather than, like, look, someone just hacked this from a temple, right? But it's a different take. It's still the same thing. You can still see that it was hacked from a temple. But instead of looking at that and looking at the conquering and the colonizing part of it, which we can continue to debate and talk about, in the meantime, we can also focus on the artistic heritage and the story that could be told through those objects too.
Wow. I like it, because now, not that you just design galleries, you're designing a journey.
Thank you.
I mean, walking into a 75,000 square feet museum, you know, you have to design the whole, the whole journey walking through and how to get excited.
But interesting. They miss anything. Oh, should I do this? You know, you're not living someone else's experience or expectation. You kind of question yourself at all times, what do I want to see and what do I think about? Which is, again, I know it's a long road for a museum to be able to do that, because we all, including myself, we were trained to follow a story. Like, oh.
Yes, of course.
Because, like, I work with a lot of museums, population, communities. A lot of them were like, it's not for us. Like when I work not only in cities but in smaller towns, and I talk to people at all times, and they said, I don't think it's for us. I was like, why? Because, and especially in America, sadly, minorities were not even allowed to go to museums until the 60s, right? So it's a big hurdle we have to go through. But when they start to kind of understand, they're like, okay, so back to what you said, we have to give them also a sense of who they are, rather than just like, you're here because we need to educate you, which museum was used in that purpose to conform people to the same story. But now we use it in a different way. It's like, you come find your own story.
So do you still believe that museum will leave a legacy, even as a
100%.
Different...
100%. You know, of course, we talk a lot about AI these days, right?
Yes, exactly.
And I'm a big fan of AI, to be honest. And, and you start to think, you know, because we went through so many technologies. Like, we're doing a big project, a museum right now in Saudi Arabia, big one. And I always talk to my team, because I'm so excited about AI. I actually send our staff to be trained in AI. We want to be at the best of the game. We want to...
Hey, do you think that AI can draft?
Oh, yeah. Well, whether you let it do it on its own or whether you want to collaborate and have them assist you is a different thing, right? I was talking to my teams, like, we're doing this big museum. On that team, it's 20 people. I said, well, imagine if you don't have CAD, which is computer-aided design, right? If we don't have CAD, how many people do you think need this project?
If you're without CAD,
it's going to be around 150 people.
Yeah, and then it will take a very long time.
It's not 200. It's now down to 20, right? But if you use AI, that 20 might become 4. So the question is, and the first thing everyone thinks is like, oh my God, we're all going to lose jobs, right? But we've been losing jobs since then. So technology should allow us to be smart too, because technology will take some job from us, but there are other jobs that technology might not be able to do as well as humans.
Exactly.
Including creativity, disruption, right? So I felt, going back to what you said, I think that humans are trained to be better because the tool that we made are doing something for us. So we have to move on to do something that the tool cannot do.
Anyway, we have to evolve because technology has pushed us to evolve. We can never stay at the same place, because with technology, we should take advantage of it and move in front. Another big question I have to ask you is, I just asked you whether you've read the book Unhumanized, but you haven't. But you must have read about Corbusier, his name as the god of boredom. And one of the things that I think I agree with Thomas saying, that it's not every building of Corbusier. Corbusier have some really fantastic beauty with right proportion and all that. But the whole idea of what Corbusier has been promoting, so many people just copy it and do exactly the same thing again and again and again, to the extent that the world now, they all look the same.
Well, I think Thomas trying to have a position.
Of course.
He
wants
to cut through the sound bite, so I don't understand. But when you make a bold statement like that, maybe half is, deserving and half is not.
Because it's a good point of discussion.
Yeah, exactly.
I think what is great is it makes you aware of what is happening. Because like when I went to Rio, I thought Rio and Seoul looks very much alike. But
But it's not just Corbusier, but it's very true that we're still living under the shadow of the modern masters.
Yeah, okay.
Right? We're dealing with, Le Corbusier doesn't have as much impact on the urban city as Mies van der Rohe.
Of course, all the office
buildings today,
yeah,
right? Those are Mies van der Rohe's towers, the glass towers.
Yeah.
Corbusier is more the concrete of the low rise.
Because, you're right. Mies is in Seagram.
But they both have a vision for the future. If anything, we should blame ourselves for not being able to evolve further.
I think the vision of the future is also the reaction of your old classical building. Mm-hmm. Because at the time, when you see all the Art Nouveau and all the 19th century or 18th century, it's all the molding, it's just a reaction.
Mm-hmm.
But then some of the buildings, it's not, when I always say that, a modernist building is great if they have the proportion.
Mm-hmm.
But some of these architects, they adopt the idea of a modernist building, but without proportion.
I agree.
So it didn't work. Yeah. So it looks horrible.
And it become a symbol rather than something, right? No, I agree. I think that architects, including Thomas, is too obsessed with style. Because it seems, and everyone trying to invent the form every time. Like, we have to have a new form, new form, new form, new form, new form. And form is emphasized over space, over life, over experience, over living, right? The price to pay, like imagine, way back when people go to the debutante gown and everyone wanted to have an haute couture dress, right? We're still living that time. Everyone want to have their own haute couture dress, even though they don't have money. They just have to have a copy of the thing that looked like that dress, right? And so, but in reality, does that dress define life? No, it's definitely not comfortable. A lot of time, it's actually not even meet with the character of the person. So I felt that, in a way, Thomas was right in pointing that we're still in the shadow of Le Corbusier, but he's long dead. He doesn't do this.
Because what I love some of your design is you don't design for yourself. You design for your client, which I think is very important. You incorporate, you know.
Yeah, and I don't want it to be the same, right? I don't want my building to look like the same thing all the time, right? Which is a reaction to the previous generation, right? Not just Ando, but Richard Meier and others.
Of course.
The style is so clear that it become like, yes, I'm going to do this building in Caracas or in Korea. It will still look alike because it's about me and my signature. I'm less interested in that because I don't think it's a proof of intelligence, to be honest. I think I like the idea going back to the cooking, right? If I want to do a fried rice in a mountain or by the sea, it will be two different dishes, even though it's the same cook, right? Because you want to engage with the local ingredients,
yes,
with the urban techniques or whatever. That's who I see myself as my achievement.
Yeah. Yes, right. True.
So it's in this weird
we always
identity
say that.
Thing.
We always say that, even with fashion, you have to be wearing the clothes, not the clothes wearing you, and which is a really important thing.
You're the case in point. The clothes never wear you.
No, you cannot, because it's your personality which is important, and choose your things that fits you. The same thing with architecture. If you own something, especially with your own house, with your own home, it has to be you.
Absolutely. And I think that's the part that it's a long journey, right? Because the modern times is quite short, right? When you think about the period that we think about Le Corbusier and other, it's a little bit more than 100 years. We live in a world which is
100
longer
years
than
now.
That, right?
Yeah.
So we're now reacting only to that because it's the history that we know and the other previous history. I think so, but there's now this longing to connect to a longer history, because what's good about modernity is about the now.
Yeah.
But knowing the now at the expense of cutting ties with everything else, with history, right? We're not supposed to talk about history.
Differentiate art and architecture.
Well, as Frank Gehry said, architecture has windows, art don't. We have toilets too,
yeah,
and we have building codes.
Because fine art, under fine art, there's architecture.
That's true. Well, but the thing is, architecture has different kind of power than art.
Much more powerful.
It's a different part. The problem, like, people want to look at architecture as sculpture, right? They go, like, "Oh, that architecture
even
is so artsy."
You know how politics or government how to project their political ideas. You know, you look at those fascist beauty.
Mm-hmm.
It just shows.
Exactly, because it's about authority.
Yeah.
It's about control, but it also have a beauty.
When I would go to Milan, I saw some of those fascist buildings. It's beautiful.
When you look at...
Powerful, beautiful.
The dictators are very smart. They always use architecture. You know, look at Hitler.
Hitler, yes, right? Of course.
With his special architect, right? They know how to use architecture.
Because they have to project power.
Exactly. And architecture is... It's an art form to celebrate, to glorify, as if living alive is already not enough. You have to do something else. But back to art. I think art, you know, I don't remember who said that, but art are like doors and windows, right, that open into different worlds that
Absolutely. You
might, you know, of course, with the internet, you feel
it's
you,
not
you
just
can search more
to,
things.
And also your community start changing.
Yeah.
And you have a complete different community, which is really inspiring because, I mean, you know, you have your business community, you have clients, and then you have a very artistic community who may be completely different from all others. And that is inspiring. That is exciting.
I agree with you. Like, when I go back to Thailand, when we have a reunion, out of 50 people, 49 are doctors. And they talk about doctors' things, like, you know, like clinics and, you know, all of those things, yeah, right? And I feel like, oh, my God, get me out of here. I don't really know how to... Not that, you know, they're doctors who are very enlightened and smart, too.
This is typical Asians. This is Asian culture.
But you're right,
it's
like,
true.
People that are curious, right? Like, I mean, not only artists, art collectors, people that are looking for things. And then I think there's a whole healthy conversation around the purpose of life.
Because I think when you have a, you know, a good topic is you have to be able to talk about everything. So, Kudabak, so what do you think about the future of architecture? I know that we've touched some about AI. So how do you imagine the future of architecture will be?
Let's just say that the field of architecture I would like it to be.
Yeah, what you would like it to be?
Is that it's so close to human life. I want people to, not that I want to lose my job, but I want people to be able to build their own homes.
Oh, yeah.
To do their own thing, right? Just like the fact that you cook your own dinner doesn't mean that you lose sight of what a good chef does.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? It's actually, you actually appreciate it more.
Exactly, exactly.
So I felt that I want architecture to be as close to people as food. So people can actually use AI or use AutoCAD or use other things to design their own things. And when they do that, hopefully they will appreciate what the professionals can give to them. And if you do that, the game is higher.
Of course. And but it's great what you said is, if they can design your own house, they will appreciate what an architect does much more. Because an architect is just like a conductor. They have to put everybody together. And the patience that you need.
You know so much about it. I think the conductor is what we need in the world.
Yeah.
Right? Because I think like diversity need a good conductor.
Absolutely.
To be able to bring those diverse voices together and not create chaos, but create harmony, create symphony.
This is only one line difference from chaos to harmony. It's really, but because you're Buddhist, that's why you talk about harmony. This is your Thai brought up.
I think so, even though when I was in Thailand, I hated the word harmony. Because it felt so sweet and so because I was longing for conflict and disruptions and things.
Oh, because this is the contrary.
Yeah, yeah. Because in Thailand, everything is so sweet and so
compliance.
Exactly. But I think the job of a conductor is not just harmony, right? But it's. Maybe it's coordination or orchestration.
It can be orchestration. Absolutely.
Yeah. So I think that, and I work a lot on culture projects that have so many voices, right? And a lot of times we architects tend to ignore those voices for the sake of make it easier to build, right? Because if you want something strong, you know, it used to be one person gave you an idea who a client just built it. You know, but that's dictator, right? We see that in the past. So
but
in
you
the
see
future,
buildings which is dictator buildings,
but in
right?
the future, if you're going to create a sense of unity by diversity, you're going to need a different kind of muscle, right? To be able to bring that strength out of diversity, which is a lot more difficult because before that, you need one person to make a building. And now you need to make 100 people.
Bravo.
You know,
I like
that.
I like this. On this note, I would like to say thank you, Kudabak, for joining me today. And I will see you in Hong Kong.
Thank you. Such an honor. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.